This is the story of stores. I'm Charlie Smart.
And I'm Helen Steck.
So, do you know what a grange is?
I have no idea what that is.
I'm not sure.
How do you spell that?
G-R-A-N-G-E.
No idea. Sorry.
So what about you? Do you know what a grange is? Well, this guy does.
Hello?
Hi, is this Mr. Miller?
Yes, it is.
That's Noel Miller.
My name's Noel Miller, and I'm president of the Connecticut State Grange.
So what exactly is a grange?
We're the oldest agricultural society in the United States. It's a family organization that was started after the Civil War to help legislation, social aspects, education for local farmers.
But how is the Grange, this agricultural society, related to the Storrs Agricultural School? Well, it has to do with this thing called a land grant. Nathan Sorber studies higher education at the University of West Virginia.
In 1862, the federal government got involved in higher education for the first time in America. And they provided public land, unclaimed public land in the West. They gave to each of the states. That land could be sold to create an endowment in support of public universities and colleges.
This was 1862, so obviously UConn, or the Storrs Agricultural School, couldn't get the grant money because, well, it didn't exist yet.
They gave the funding to Yale. There actually wasn't any other kind of competing candidate. Yale agreed to house the land grant in their scientific school.
So Yale,
or more specifically, the Sheffield Scientific School,
they took the grant money, and for about a decade, they lived happily with it.
Actually, the Yale Scientific School was one of the best places for scientific study and research in the country in the 1860s. A lot of leading scientists.
But there is a catch.
See, the Morrill Act, the law that created the land grant back in 1862, was pretty specific about what kind of school got the money. It had to be a place
where the leading object shall be, without excluding other scientific and classical studies, and including military tactics, to teach such branches of learning as are related to agriculture and the mechanic arts.
So, an agricultural school.
Or at least that's how the Connecticut Grange interpreted it. There was one guy in particular who cared a lot about the land grant.
If you're looking for a colorful character as part of this movement, there was this gentleman named the Peach King. He was the leading peach farmer in Connecticut named J.H. Hale, and he was a leader in the Grange movement.
Hale was an interesting guy.
He started a lot of granges in the northeastern sections and central sections of Connecticut as state master.
Obviously, though, as his nickname suggests, he's more famous for his legendary peach.
You can actually still buy it today. It's called the J.H. Hale peach, and it was unique because it was able to withstand the cold New England weather,
where other kinds of peaches would have died.
He's also got something in common with Noel Miller.
He had my job, yep.
That was Noel Miller again, and he's right. J.H. Hale, the Peach King, was master of the Connecticut Grange, same as him.
Well, almost the same.
You know, mine's not a full-time job as his is.
So, anyway, Hale was upset.
Because Yale was the state's land-grant college, but Hale didn't think they were quite living up to the agricultural requirement of the Morrill Act.
The farmers, particularly the Grange, determined that, Yale wasn't graduating very many farmers.
That's Bruce Stave.
We talked to him last episode. He's the UConn history professor who literally wrote the book on UConn history. Anyway.
It was set up in a classical mold of Oxford and Cambridge and such. They were not happy with this.
Nathan Sorber.
And when he looked at Yale and who was attending or who was benefiting from the land grant, he found that it was the same group of middle class, upper middle class, or children of professionals who seemed to be the primary beneficiaries of going to Yale, going to the Sheffield School. What really upset him, though, is when farmers or the children of farmers went to Yale or went to the Sheffield School, they didn't want to be farmers anymore.
As the leader of an agricultural society, that didn't sit well with him.
Hale found that in 24 years, Yale had only graduated 7 students from its agricultural program.
Compare that to the Storr School, which graduated 13 farmers in 1891 alone. Even more of a problem, the entrance requirements to get into Yale were high.
You needed to know Latin, so I already know I wouldn't have gotten in.
You also needed to know algebra and trigonometry. And, let's be honest, none of those things were usually taught to rural farm boys.
So on December 7th, 1886, Hale took this information and presented it before the Connecticut State Grange.
The Hartford Courant reported him saying,
"The requirements practically exclude 99 out of every 100 who expect to be farmers, for whose benefit this fund was intended."
Then he dropped the real bombshell of the night. He said,
"This money, or at least a large portion of it, should go to the Storr School, the real agricultural college of our state."
He also pointed out that the Storr School didn't have such high admissions requirements, so it wouldn't exclude as many boys. Still, not everyone was convinced.
James Olcott.
Remember him, JBO.
He wrote after the Grange meeting that if the Storr School got the money, admissions requirements would be raised and, quote, "common boys couldn't get into it with a ladder."
Olcott really wasn't a fan of Hale in general. He wrote,
"I can't train in Hale's gang without protesting. And really, one of my problems is how much to hate him."
So Hale presents his argument at the Grange meeting, and people take notice.
The Grange starts to rally behind moving the land grant to the Storr School.
They became a big voting bloc.
All these farmers, Grange members, from across the state start writing letters to newspapers.
Writing letters to state representatives.
Really putting pressure on the legislature to do something.
J.H. Hale actually got himself elected to the Connecticut state legislature on this issue.
But see, they weren't super successful at first.
The legislature first officially recognized the movement in January 1887 and basically said, "Okay, we'll look into this."
But then in April that year, they passed a statement saying, "Well, we're in contract with Yale and they haven't really done anything wrong, so tough luck."
It wasn't for another few years that anything really happened.
Nathan Sorber explains.
There were two moral acts. There was the one in 1862, but the big game changer was in 1890. And that second moral act authorized direct $15,000 a year to grow by $1,000 each year. But these direct grants that would come from the federal government to land grant institutions.
Old house, we say goodbye. It's just a little...
See, this new cash was a big deal.
Because before, with the first moral act, the amount of land and thus money given to the state was based on the size of the state's congressional delegation.
Since Connecticut was small, we didn't get as much land as other states.
It was enough money to help out an existing school.
Like Yale.
But not enough money to start up a new one.
But when the second moral act was passed, there was suddenly more money available.
And the Grange, once that happened, they said, "Oh wait, there's enough money that can help us build a new institution."
And ultimately, the state legislature agreed. So on April 21st, 1893,
exactly 12 years after the bill founding the Storr's Agricultural School was passed,
the General Assembly passed an act transferring the land grant money, all of it, the original money and the 1890 money, to the Storr's Agricultural School.
Except the money didn't technically go to the Storr's Agricultural School, because they also changed the name.
The Storr's Agricultural School became the Storr's Agricultural College.
One step closer to where we are today. But see, the story doesn't end here.
Yale wasn't happy. And I mean, it's not hard to see why.
Imagine you're Yale back then. True, they weren't graduating many farmers, but it's not like they were completely misusing the land grant money.
Nathan Sorber.
These folks are doing great things. They're making farmers more profitable because they're helping explain and invent new fertilizers. It's just a different argument about where the benefit is conveyed to the people.
Some leading agricultural scientists were working at Yale at the time.
The guy that's named the father of agricultural science, Samuel Johnson at Sheffield, had built close partnerships.
The Grange disagreed. They wanted the money to go to the Storr's Agricultural School, so they threw their support behind them.
Interesting side note, the Grange still officially lobbies for UConn today. Grange Master Noel Miller.
The State Grange legislative committee has a policy handbook that we give out to each representative and senators in Connecticut.
And in that book, they officially support the agriculture school at UConn.
Anyway, Yale was upset.
You know, there wasn't much really that Yale could do by the 1890s. The Grange was at its full strength and the legislature was against them. Then it turned to an issue of damages in the court.
So Yale says they're not going to comply, and they put together this list of 15 points explaining why they think transferring the funds to stores is ridiculous.
And to be honest, they made some pretty good points. I mean, right off the bat, they did have a contract with the state that they signed when they accepted the land grant back in 1862, and the state pretty much broke it by transferring the funds.
They also pointed to the fact that the General Assembly had already said they were working in the boundaries of the original Land Grant Act. Remember, back when the Grange first tried to get the funds transferred in 1887.
None of the points really address Hale's complaint that the school was too hard for farmers to get into, but that makes sense because at this point it was really a legal battle, not a personal one.
Yale filed their case with the United States Circuit Court, and during that time, the judge put a restraining order on the land grant funds.
So Yale didn't have them, but they couldn't be paid to UConn yet either.
And the result of that case annoyed, well, everyone.
Because the judge decided he couldn't make the state pay Yale any damages, but he also maintained the restraining order on the money.
So now nobody had the cash, and really nobody was happy.
Obviously, Yale wasn't just going to leave it there, so they called on a section of the act that transferred the money to stores, which said if there were any disagreements like this, a committee of three people could be set up to sort it out.
The committee was set up, and in the end, they decided, yeah, Yale deserved to be paid some damages.
The state had to pay Yale a total of $154,604.
That's a little over $4 million in today's money.
So Yale got paid, UConn got the land grant status, and things were pretty much settled in the courts.
Outside of the courts was a different story.
There was a lot of bitterness that was involved.
That's Bruce Stave again.
There was a tension that developed between Yale and UConn for a number of years as a consequence of this.
The real question is, what was the point of all this?
It took the better part of a decade from when Hale first made his pitch at the Grange meeting to when the store school actually got the land grant fund.
What was it all for?
Until 1900, things didn't change that much. They got some, you know, they used the money, they built a new, the foundation of the new kind of residence hall where most folks would live, the foundation of that building. They did hire a handful of new faculty, but the big kind of significant change happened in 1901 when George Flint came in.
Which, well, that's a story for another time.
Walter Stemmons argues in his 1937 history of UConn that the real boost to the store school came not through the money, but through exposure. He wrote, quote,
"It was the first great wave of publicity that the little school in the hills of Mansfield had ever experienced."
The school started to grow after this publicity.
The following year, they took on 59 new students and had to turn away 30 because they simply didn't have room. Clubs started to pop up, like the student newspaper in 1896.
They opened some new academic departments and hired new professors.
That little farm school in Stores was, for the first time, becoming a college. The Story of Stores is a production of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. It is produced by Helen Steck and me, Charlie Smart. Special thanks to Noel Miller, Nathan Sorber, and Bruce Stave.
Music for this episode was provided by Kula, Quantum Jazz, Kevin McLeod, Jim Rooster, Topher Moore and Alex Alina, David Mumford, Silent Partners, John Dealey and the 41 Players, and Broke for Free.
You can tweet at us. I'm at Charlie R. Smart.
And I'm at H. Steck. We'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, or suggestions for new episodes. If you like this podcast, please rate it and subscribe on iTunes.
That would help us out a lot.
Next time on The Story of Stores.
This country is interrupting the civil rights of people in Vietnam to live, to have an existence.
I know that President Babbage promised that the Riot Act would not be read. It was read.
They really think that I ordered them to read the Riot Act.